Hello, and welcome to episode 15 of Professors in Rooms Getting Coffee with Dr. Justin Winzenberg and me, Stephen Jones. In today's episode, we talk with Mark Charles, who's running as an independent in the 2020 election for President of the United States. This is the first part of a two-part conversation with Mark. So what's been a highlight for you this week?
So one of the highlights for this week for me was listening to Postulating Solutions with Preachers podcast.
Hey, there you go.
You know, recently they had Propaganda and John Foreman on the podcast. And so, you know, John and Pastor Watts had an interesting discussion with them. And one of the things I think that stuck out to me the most about that and what made it a highlight for me was hearing a couple of the comments that Pastor Watts had to say about things like welfare and prison reform. And I think, how did he put it? He calls it the prison industrial complex. So for our listeners who don't know what that is, I recommend that you go and check out the podcast. But what was part of the enjoyment for me, I guess, in listening to that was, you know, I've got friends who work in a Capitol here in Minnesota, and there's a lot of discussion around things like welfare and the necessity of welfare. And it's something that I think I've just taken for granted and thought, yeah, it's a good thing to help people out. But Pastor Watts kind of talks in the podcast about some of the dangers of the welfare system, and then he proposes some better solutions. And I thought it was fascinating. He also addresses just the concept of racism historically in the U.S., as well as how that has impacted what's happening now. And I think he has some really interesting thoughts about that. So maybe I'll save some of that for the insight, which then won't be my insight. It'll be stealing from Pastor Watt, but it was good. I really recommend the podcast for folks to go and check it out. And then having Propaganda and John Foreman on there. And for those, Propaganda is a Christian hip hop artist, and John Foreman's a lead singer of Switchfoot. And I thought it was an interesting conversation between all four of them, because Propaganda brings in some components from his experiences out in California. And John Foreman's out there, I think, as well, isn't he?
Yeah, he is.
Yeah. So it was interesting. How about for you?
Yeah. So two highlights, I guess. One is, so I got to help produce that episode. And so that was a lot of fun to, you know, to watch these guys interacting, you know, as we're recording the podcast. And yeah, it was just fun to be involved with that.
Yeah.
And then actually the other highlight relates to that, which was that we got our first donation toward the production costs of both this and that podcast.
Oh, really? Nice. Yeah. Oh,
that's so cool. That was great. So yeah, actually we were just talking with somebody this week about helping to do some of the editing. Cause I mean, I'm having fun with this and I'd like to keep going with it, but yeah, it's been taking a little bit more time than I feel like I can give. And so, yeah, so that was fun anyway.
Yeah, I know how much work you put into it. So I'm glad to hear that there could be some help coming for you.
Yeah. Yeah. That was fun.
So what's a low light for you?
I think a low light for me. So one of the things, actually, we'll just stay on the podcast with Watts. There was an initiative that Watts has been pushing for, I don't know, I feel like it's been a couple of months now, basically saying that a certain percentage of the CARE Act funds, so this is the coronavirus response from the federal government, there's a whole bunch of money that got given to the states and has just been sitting there waiting, basically. The initial restrictions were too tight for the states to use it unless they had a huge coronavirus outbreak.
Sure.
So then now that the federal government is starting to loosen the restrictions, the states are starting to figure out what to do with it. And recently, so Watts is in West Virginia, and he's been saying, hey, of this, let's take 20%, which I think ends up being $250 million, and put it to, so things like welfare and other things like that, but to make it more accessible. One of the biggest issues is people can't get to these service centers, or they can't get access to workers. Anyway, well, so the West Virginia governor made an announcement. If I understand it right, and I may not, if I understand it right, it sounded like, no, none of the money is going to go toward poverty, but $100 million is going to go toward roads.
And obviously, oh, man.
Look, roads are important, right? But this is like, but you should be paying for your roads as a state.
Yeah.
Because that's part of what you do. Like, that's, in my mind, one of the main functions of a state is to make its own infrastructure work. You know, this was an opportunity to really address some of these deeply rooted systemic poverty issues. And it connects to health in that some of these things are the social determinants of health.
Right? No
kidding. So it's just disappointing. So how about for you? What's a low light?
Oh, man. You know, I feel like some of my low lights are just scrapping at the surface here, scratching at the surface. Nothing too societal actually today for me, I guess. One of the lowlights for me is related to something I brought up several weeks ago, just about cars and having car troubles. And of course, the last time that I was on my way up to do some work on my mother-in-law's cabin, our car broke down and I had to get a new battery for my van. And this time, right as we're about to leave, I realized that the battery on my wife's car is about 8 years old. So, so time to change it out. Now, changing out a battery is nothing, right? I mean, it doesn't take much time, but it just kind of has that idea in my head, like, you know, just when you think you got things fixed and you got things ready to go and you're going to be fine on the road, there's just something else that needs to be fixed. Right. And so there's just this constant like needing to do all this work on stuff just to keep it up and running. I don't know. I can't complain about it because compared to the governor of West Virginia's statements, I think on poverty, you know, my having to do small fixes on my vehicle are pretty pretty minuscule. But it's just this constant sense of like I'm needing to attend to these things, and it's it can just be a bit of a bummer sometimes.
Yeah, no, that totally makes sense.
Yeah. So, an insight.
Yeah. What's an insight for you? Oh, you were talking about the podcast.
Yeah, right? So it's not my insight. I want to play a little bit off of an insight that Pastor Watts brought up in his podcast. And that was some of the things he had mentioned about slavery, I think, were quite illuminating. One of the things he said was, you know, bring up some quotes from various people throughout history who suggested that if you enslave a people, that you better enslave them in perpetuity, or else you're going to feel the effects of it in the generations that follow. And he suggested that some of the ills of society that we're seeing today are certainly related to the fact that in our history, we enslaved a whole population of people.
Yeah. What did he say? Something about like, this is the natural trajectory, right? Like, this is where you would expect it would be.
Exactly. As he brought that up, he talked a lot about how there have been shifts also in terms of the workforce and how there was a place for Black folks in society as useful when it comes to the working class. For one, they were useful in slavery because they were being used to do all sorts of labor.
Were you uncomfortable as he was saying that? I was uncomfortable with the language. It makes sense. I understand what he's saying, but it's just,
The reason why I wasn't uncomfortable with it, just to be clear why I wasn't, is because I think what Watts wasn't saying was that somehow Black folks' inherent worth was tied to that in actuality. I think he was just talking about for the sake of society or for as the U.S. government saw it, the usefulness of Black folks was directly tied to doing work. I think that's what he meant. You disagree?
No, I think you're right. It just felt gross, you know?
Of course, I will not dispute that whatsoever. I think you're absolutely right. But it was interesting to think, again, this is something that's been highlighted in several episodes that we've done with various people, which is the idea of how important it is to understand our history in this country, especially. And I think that maybe now, in light of some of the things that are being brought up, and this will be interesting in light of today's episode with Mark Charles, is to think a little bit more about the consequences of our historical past in the U.S. And how that has some direct implication for things that are happening in our world now. So that's an insight that I'm going to kind of leave open-ended for our discussion with Mark, and we can reflect on it more as we go. Yeah. But it's something that I think was initially brought up here in my thinking through the Postulating Solutions with Preachers podcast that I'd listened to this past week. What's an insight for you?
So it's related to your insight. It's not quite the same, but I've been seeing some folks posting about critical race theory. And what's interesting is they're posting it from a negative perspective, saying critical race theory is bad and it's the reason why we're having the social turmoil that we are.
Like, we're talking just the average folks on Facebook are posting this, or are you talking about people in academia?
Yeah, a combination. So I've been thinking about that. And I remember when I was doing my master's, one of the things that I came across was this idea that in communications research, this particular set of authors, Martin Nakayama and Flores, were suggesting three primary approaches to communications research. And they were a social science approach, which tends a bit more positivist, a critical approach, and an interpretivist approach. So one of the things that I have tried to do, I mean, you know, I don't have a whole lot of sympathy for the social science approach in the sense of the positivist manifestations of that. But I do find a lot of value personally in the interpretivist approach, like trying to understand when somebody says something, what does that mean to them? Why are they doing that? Trying to get inside, you know, other people's experience of the world. I have worked to make my students aware of the critical approach, which includes this idea of what is power doing, who stands to benefit from different things. You know, there are historical elements of that. And so, yeah. You know, one of the things that I've been kind of thinking about with that is critical race theory, among other things, says that basically the racism is embedded in the legal structure of the society. It was an approach that came out of legal studies first. Mm. It's fascinating. Actually, I was doing a little bit of reading about critical race theory. Mm. And one of the things that I read was a Marxist critique of it and saying, here's why it's bad. And basically it's because it takes the attention off of class, right? As the main thing, and off of the economy moves it to race, which, so it's interesting that, you know, it's a theory that can be attacked from multiple perspectives, I guess. I'm more comfortable functioning in the interpretivist frame. You know, why are you saying what you're saying? What does it mean to you? How do we find some kind of agreement? But how do we find a space where we're understanding things, you know, kind of this mutually co-created space. But the thing is, if the insights of critical race theory are founded, if there are legal things, sorry, this is vague. Okay. If there are ways in which the law actually does favor mm-hmm. one race over another, or one race over others, plural, right? Then in some ways, the interpretivist approach is insufficient and may actually be an exercise of privilege itself. On the other hand, I feel really uncomfortable sometimes once we get into a fully critical approach, because once you decide to look at everything at the systemic level, it's easy to lose the humanity of the people who are in it, which means that sometimes I've interacted with people who are coming from a critical perspective that I think I agree with their insights, but I don't necessarily agree with their approach. And I think that you can miss this in any of the others too, right? In the social science or the interpretivist, but when you miss love, right? So, and I'm just thinking like as a Jesus follower, when you miss love in the critical approach, I feel like it just gets
nasty.
I don't know. It's a spiral, you know?
But there's a danger, I think, in using love as a paradigm that then softens the blow of the necessary prophetic call. No, the necessary prophetic call out that needs to happen in the midst of brutally horrifying social and systemic reality. So,
and I think that's a risk, right? That love can be manipulated, right? To say, don't make me feel uncomfortable. And that's not really what love is, right?
No, and I even think about some of Jesus's own methods in calling out the injustices of his own time, and how Jesus loves me, this I know, for the Bible tells me so, right? So like, does Jesus love everybody? Well, sure. Did that prevent him from calling out some of the systems of oppression of his own time in some fairly straightforward and awkwardly uncomfortable ways? Not at all. So there's got to mm-hmm. be this sense where it's like, well, if we believe that Jesus loves all people, that didn't seem to prevent him from saying some pretty rough things to people who needed to be called out.
Yeah, definitely.
So there has to be some of that tension, right? That you can call out the social and systemic structural injustices while at the same time not dehumanizing the people, you know, who may be behind that.
We'll be back in a moment with presidential candidate Mark Charles. So I'm really excited to have with us today Mark Charles, who, I don't know, it's been probably 8 years since we've seen each other. I had met you at a Christian Community Development Association conference, and you were kind enough to take some time to explain some things to me. And so I've always kind of had in the back of my mind an awareness of who you are. And then somebody told me recently that you were running for president, and I was like, well, we need to check this out because, yeah. Anyway, would you be willing to introduce yourself, Mark?
Absolutely. So, yate, Mark Charles Yunus, yeah. Sin bake denanisme, the toy higuni bashishin. Sin bake denan dashiche, the toy chini dashinella. In our Navajo culture, when we introduce ourselves, we always give our four clans. We're matrilineal as a people, and our identities come from our mother's mother. Now, my mother's mother is American of Dutch heritage, and so that's why I say sin bake denan. Loosely translated, that means I'm from the Wooden Shoe people. My second clan, my father's mother, is Pohidlini, which is the waters that flow together. My third clan, my mother's father, is also Tsinbake Dene. And then my fourth clan, my father's father, is Totochitni, and that's the Bitterwater clan. It's one of the original clans of our Navajo people. I also just want to acknowledge, as I do everywhere I speak, the land where I am on. And so I'm speaking to you from Washington, D.C. I moved here with my family about 5 years ago. And this area where D.C. sits is the traditional land of the Piscataway. So the Piscataway are the nation that lived here. They hunted here. They farmed here. They fished here. They raised their families here. They buried their dead here. This was the nation that existed here long before Columbus got lost at sea. And I want to acknowledge them as the host people of the land on which I'm living. And I want to thank them for their stewardship of these lands that they've had for hundreds, even thousands of years.
Mark, one of the things that as I've seen you speak before, you have different ways of communicating about our present and about our past that help bring things to life in a way that I think sometimes there are things that are difficult for us to understand or wrap our mind around. Last week, we were talking with a Native woman on the podcast and realizing I was looking up whose land I live on, right? And I realized that I don't even know how to say the names of the tribes that this land had been stewarded by. And I think the ways in which we don't remember have really intense consequences. Today. Yeah. And if you'd be willing to tell us, there's a story that you've used to kind of communicate some of what it means to acknowledge the hosts of the land.
Yeah. Let me jump in there, because a lot of what I'm doing right now, the conversation I'm trying to do, and even in my campaign, and something I've been advocating for in the book I've written, as well as in my work over the past decade or so, one of the primary pieces I'm advocating for is what I'm calling a national dialogue on race, gender, and class. A conversation that I would put on par with the Truth and Reconciliation Commissions that happened in South Africa and Rwanda and in Canada. I wouldn't call ours Truth and Reconciliation, though, because reconciliation implies there was a previous harmony, which when you learn the history, study the past, didn't exist racially here in this country. So I would call it Truth and Conciliation. And the way I got to that, some of my entrance into this vision, into this understanding of what I feel is needed, happened almost now nearly two decades ago. It was early 2000s. I was the pastor of a church in Denver called the Christian Indian Center. And while I was there, the congregation, which was primarily Native American and mostly Navajo, the Christian Indian Center was started as a ministry of the Christian Reformed Church to the Native population in Denver, probably almost 50 years ago now. And they had had other pastors before me, but I was a Native pastor and they hadn't had a Native pastor in a while when I got there. And one of the first things that the council, the elders of the church, said to me when I met with them in my first council meeting is they said, our last pastor introduced us to the idea of contextualizing worship, and we'd like you to lead us into that. I said, that sounds great. How do you spell it? Like, what do you mean? No clue what they were talking about. And they said, well, there's this conference going on next month in Hawaii called the World Christian Gathering on Indigenous Peoples. Mm. And it's a 2-week conference in Hawaii and two different islands in Hawaii. And we're going to send you and your wife there because they're talking about and teaching about contextualizing worship. I said, for nothing other than the sake of the gospel, I will pick up that cross and carry it to Hawaii with me, with my wife and our son. So we went to Hawaii and met Native Indigenous Christians from all over the world who were learning how to, what I would call, decolonize their faith. So most Native Indigenous Christians have the experience of being colonized by the gospel. Missionaries came and they didn't just come and say, hey, there's this guy Jesus, you should hear about him. They came and say, here's this guy Jesus. He only accepts you if you speak English. You have to give up your pagan ceremonies and celebrate the Easter Bunny and Santa Claus. You have to learn our language. You have to practice our culture. I mean, they came and literally committed cultural genocide as they forcibly assimilated us to Western culture so that we could now have a relationship with this person they talked so highly about named Jesus. And So even my grandparents were converted, became Christians under this guise. Both my grandparents were boarding school survivors. Mm. They, they accepted Christ, but because of the message and the way it came, they didn't teach the language to my father. They didn't practice the traditional culture at home. And so I grew up very colonized. Not only was I living on the compound of the mission that had run the boarding school in that area, Rehoboth Christian School was the school I went to, was transitioning from being a boarding school to a day school, but it still had boarding school students there while I was there. I was there as a day school student, but we had a history of 80 years of being a boarding school in that area. And my grandparents were working as translators there. My father was helping teach in the school. My mother had come there as a missionary, nurse, actually on her way to Africa. And so it was a very colonized environment, where, again, native culture, native language, native understanding of what is sacred, the Navajo conception of time was not valued or taught. Everything was about assimilating to Western European culture. And so I understood immediately what they were talking about. And we began seeing example after example of different tribes and different peoples from all over the world coming to worship Jesus in the fullness of their culture. Mm. And it was a fascinating, eye-opening experience. And it's so, so powerful that within 2 years, my wife and I decided to actually leave Denver and go back to the reservation so we could actually be living among my people. Mm-hmm. And if we felt if we really wanted to engage and even lead in this movement, we had to be back on the reservation. I had grown up, in this Dutch ghetto just off the reservation. I had attended this, what used to be a boarding school, was a private school when I was there. I never lived on the reservation with my people. And so we felt we had to be back on the reservation. So my wife and I moved back. There was a member of the church that we were serving in Denver. And I was actually related to the husband through clan, and his wife, her family had grown up in a very remote part of the reservation where she had been sent to boarding school. And they said, we have a hogan on a sheep camp out there that you can live in. And that was perfect. That's exactly what we wanted, because we wanted to live as traditionally as we possibly could. And so we moved into the sheep camp. It was 6 miles off the nearest paved road on a dirt road. No running water, no electricity. The community, people we live near, have almost no neighbors. There were a few people on the sheep camp where we lived. Our next closest neighbor was about 2 miles away. Our neighbors, people in the area, were rug weavers and shepherds, most of them boarding school survivors with not much education. And we moved there completely prepared to live off the grid. Like, we knew we'd have to haul water and cook over a camp stove or over an open fire and live by candlelight. We prepared to live off the grid. But what caught us by surprise, what completely kind of emotionally floored us, was how intensely isolated we were. It literally felt like we dropped off the face of the earth. And quickly observed that the only non-natives we ever met living in that remote part of the reservation were people who came to give us charity, or people who came to take our picture. And oftentimes they were the same group of people. Hmm. Almost no one came for the sake of building relationship. I could count on a single hand the number of non-natives who came to visit us in that hogan that first year. And it was very disturbing. And I was there kind of taken back by all of this. I was experiencing and witnessing the historical trauma of my people. I was feeling this intense marginalization from our country. I was getting exposed to more and more of the history, learning about the doctrine of discovery, learning about what had happened on these lands in a very real way. And the longer I lived there, even in that first year or two, we were in that hogan for 3 years. We were on the reservation for a total of 11 years. And I could feel myself getting more and more angry, like just becoming insecure and becoming angry. And I was on the phone writing letters, talking with my non-native friends. Again, they weren't coming to the reservation, so we were communicating by phone, by email. And I was trying to explain to them how it felt. And every time we would talk about it, I could feel the tension rising. And soon I'd have to hang up the phone because I'd want to start yelling at them. So I learned how to kind of temper myself, and I could talk about it almost like it was something I read in the newspaper. I was emotionally disconnected from what I was saying, and that let me stay in the conversation longer. But then the longer I was in the conversation, the more the defenses of my friends rose up.
Right.
And soon they would hang up the phone because they were so, it wasn't my family that did that to you. It wasn't our people that, and soon they would want to hang up the phone, and I wasn't getting anywhere. And so one day I was sitting there And I was writing a letter to my friend. This is like the 10th time trying to get him to understand how it felt to live on an Indian reservation in the middle of the United States of America. And in my letter, I said to them, I said, being Native and living on an Indian reservation in this country, it feels like our Native communities are this old grandmother who has a very large and a very beautiful house. And years ago, some people came into our house and they locked us upstairs in the bedroom. Today, our house is full of people. They're sitting on the furniture. They're eating our food. They're having a party inside our house. Now, they've since come upstairs and they've unlocked the door to our bedroom, but it's much later and we're tired, we're old, we're weak, we're sick, so we can't or we don't come out. But the thing that hurts us the most, what causes us the most pain, is that virtually nobody from this party ever comes upstairs, seeks out the grandmother in the bedroom, sits down next to her on the bed, takes her hand, and simply says, thank you. Thank you for letting us be in your house. I wrote that and I'm like, that's it. That's exactly what I'm feeling. I started sharing that with people around me, people in our sheep camp, people who lived in the area. And some would come back to me and say, you know, I've lived here a long time, even all my life, and it's been a struggle to articulate how it feels, and you're hitting the nail on the head. I started sharing that with non-natives. And instead of getting defensive and angry, they would come back and they would say, what does it mean to say thank you? Mm-hmm. How does my family, how does my community, how does my church, how does my city, how does my state, how does my country express gratitude to the indigenous hosts of Turtle Island? See, now we're having a very different conversation. Now, right, instead of discussing victim versus oppressor, now we're having a discussion on what I think is the root of the situation, which is this reversal of roles, where this nation, which likes to call itself a nation of immigrants, which isn't true. Calling the United States a nation of immigrants excludes two groups of people. It excludes African people who were brought here against their will and enslaved, and it excludes Native peoples who never immigrated here, were indigenous to these lands. So there's a reversal of roles where we have a nation. Yes, a majority of them are undocumented immigrants who have never asked for, going back 400, 500 years, nor have they ever been given permission to be here. And they run around acting like they own the place. Meanwhile, we have about 6 million indigenous peoples, the host people of the land, who've been moved aside to reservations and out of the way communities. And we're being treated like unwanted guests in someone else's home. We have a reversal of roles. In some very real and practical ways, I need this nation to understand whether their family came across on the Mayflower or whether they jumped a fence last week, that they're guests in someone else's house. And I want our Native peoples to understand that we are the host people of the land, and we have to conduct ourselves as the host. And I've used that metaphor for almost a decade now to initiate dialogue about what are the challenges we're facing as a nation and how do we begin to talk about them in a way that's honest, but also opens up the dialogue for people to participate.
It's really interesting. The layers here, right? There are anthropological things, like what do we view humanity to mean? There are theological questions, and there are these things that are deeply connected to our sense of self and who we understand ourselves to be. But I think there's also these really interesting practical questions that come out of that. So like your decision to run as an independent is a reflection of those kind of maybe more philosophical understandings, but also this pragmatic reality. And I was listening to something you were talking about. You spent the first 7 months of your campaign among Native peoples because you knew that if you started your campaign the way that most campaigns start, which is Iowa and New Hampshire, that it would flavor your campaign, right, in a way that was actually inconsistent with who you were wanting to be, which is a president for all of the people. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah. So one of the biggest misnomers, and people accuse me of this all the time, is that because I'm running as an independent, I have no chance of winning. And I'm just going to be the spoiler. And I get accused by Democrats daily of just wanting to put Trump back in office. And the reason I ran as an independent, not because it was a vanity game for me, but because I actually want to be president. I really want to be president. I believe I'm the best person, the most qualified person for the job, and I want to be president. And had I run as a Democrat, yes, I would have raised more money. Yes, I would have probably been in the debates. Yes, more people would have heard of me. I promise you, I never would have been nominated. Never. Why? Iowa has a state law requiring them to be the first caucus state. Mm. They became the first caucus state after the civil rights movement, after the assassination of Dr. King, after people of color were given greater voice politically. Iowa, which is the sixth whitest state in the country and has the highest percentage of private land, became the first caucus state. Why? Because now that people of color had the right to vote, the party had to make sure that the pathway to the White House ran through white landowning men. New Hampshire was already the first primary state. They go back almost over 100 years as the first primary state, I think. New Hampshire also has a state law requiring them to be the first primary state. New Hampshire is like the fourth whitest state in the country, and they have the highest percentage of home ownership of any state in the union. So because both the Democrats and the Republicans adhere to these state laws and run their primary campaigns through Iowa and New Hampshire, they are allowing white landowning men to be the gatekeeper for presidential politics. And so this is why, when whether you announce as a Democrat or a Republican, the first place these candidates run off to is to Iowa and New Hampshire. And they spend almost a year campaigning in Iowa and New Hampshire, learning how to make their platforms palatable to white landowning men. And I realized if I had to do that, I would either never be nominated or I would lose the soul of my message and not be able to enact any real change. Mm-hmm. Those are the two options. And so I also knew, and this is from living on the reservation, where I watched two presidential campaigns from the reservation, and I witnessed that you could actually become president without campaigning to a single Native person. The Navajo Nation is 26,000 square miles with 300,000 enrolled tribal members, about 200,000 living on our reservation. If we were a state, we'd be the 40th largest state. And no one campaigned to us. Why? Because we reside in Four Corners area and we have land in Colorado, Wyoming, and New Mexico. And we don't have a single congressional district in any of those states. So we have almost no impact in the Electoral College. Mm-hmm. And most reservations are tiny compared to ours. And so natives have been pushed aside, moved around. So we have almost zero impact on the Electoral College. And so you can become president without ever campaigning to Native people. And I deeply believe that if you want to be president of these lands that encompass Turtle Island, the most appropriate and respectful place to begin your campaign is not to the white landowning men in Iowa, New Hampshire, but to the indigenous hosts of Turtle Island. And so I ran as independent so that I could spend the first 7 months of my campaign taking my message first to the indigenous hosts of Turtle Island. And that's exactly what I did. And I would do it again if I had to. Did it cost me? Yeah, it cost me publicity. It cost me money. It cost me, you know, nothing. Very little got covered about my campaign during those first 7 months because the country doesn't cover Indian country. And yet I feel very strongly that that was the most appropriate and respectful way to begin a campaign for president of the United States. And I wish every candidate would do something like that to not just symbolic me, but into a meaningful way, acknowledge the indigenous hosts of Turtle Island.
And this has policy implications, right? I mean, there's this ethic that you're communicating. There's a sense of who you want to be. There are also these policy questions. I remember one of the things that was really striking to me, we were at a conference and you were speaking about immigration reform and how there was an immigration reform letter that had been drafted and there was a request that, you know, different folks sign on. And at some point you realized that there had been no Native voices at the table. And it's this kind of thing that it should occur to us, right? Yeah. That immigration reform without Native voices just doesn't even make any sense.
Yeah.
What kinds of perspectives are we missing in our policymaking process? What voices are we missing as we think through that?
So many. I mean, one of the things I say, and I've told stories about this, I don't know if we have time to go all the way into it, but I tell people that without Natives at the table, the United States of America is incapable of comprehensively and justly reforming immigration law. Without Natives at the table, all you have is one generation of undocumented immigrants trying to figure out what to do with another generation of undocumented immigrants. And there's no integrity in the dialogue. It doesn't matter if you're building a wall to keep people out or tearing one down to let people in. If Native peoples are not at the center of the dialogue, this nation has no integrity to do either. And I think because, you know, one of the themes of my campaign is this quote used by George Erasmus, who's a Native elder from the Dene people up in Canada. And he said that where common memory is lacking, where people do not share in the same past, there can be no real community. If you want to build community, he says you have to start by creating common memory. I love that quote. It gets to the heart of our nation's problem with race. And it identifies some of the key problems that we have, which is we don't have a common memory. We have a white majority mm-hmm. that remembers a mythological history of discovery and expansion, opportunity and exceptionalism. And we have communities of color and other marginalized groups that have the lived experience of stolen land, broken treaties, slavery, Jim Crow laws, boarding schools, Indian massacres, segregation, mass incarceration, families being ripped apart at our borders, internment camps. And there's no common memory. And therefore, it's not a surprise that community, healthy community across racial lines has never existed in the United States. Mm-hmm. And so when you look at this lack of a common memory, and you look at this nation as being led by a demographic of people who have never lost a war that matters, and therefore they've written their own history for 250 years. Yes, immigration is one of the huge blind spots we have, but foreign policy is huge as well. One of the nominations I'm most looking forward to making as president is I want to nominate a Native person, an Indigenous person, as my Secretary of State. Mm. Could you imagine if this nation was not only led by an Indigenous president, but our primary ambassador to the world was someone who was Indigenous to these lands? And I use the conflict in Israel as just a single example where the U.S. for the past 50 years has sent people to the Middle East to negotiate a 2,000 plus year old land dispute that we helped exacerbate. Mm-hmm. And the people we're sending can't even name the tribe that was ethnically cleansed from the land where their own house sits back here in the U.S. Mm-hmm. And we're sending them to negotiate some kind of peace between a 2,000-year-old land dispute that they very much have taken a side on. It's insane. This is why we can't, I mean, the U.S., at least the people we send there, have no authority or integrity to be involved in these kind of dialogues. You know, one of the things I look forward to when I become president is actually sitting down with our allies. Why? Well, most of our allies are colonial nations. This is why they're our allies, right? Mm-hmm. Most of our allies, our closest allies, colonized most of the world. There's a reason why we're such close friends with Great Britain, France, Germany, the Netherlands. Because we share these deep, we don't share values for equality and freedom. We share values of colonialism. And so not that we have to break off relationship with our allies, but we have to examine our relationship with our allies. Why are we so close to them? And what does it look like to create not just a common memory here nationally? What does it look like to have a more and a better common memory globally? Mm-hmm. And to begin to identify what is it that aligns us with our allies in the first place? And do we need to change what we hold in common with those nations? Do we have to have some truth telling and some stories being shared and some acknowledgement in those relationships as well? And so, yeah, there is so many things that our nation does not know how to deal with. And the third one, and I'll bring this up. You know, I'm wearing my hair, my CA, which is my traditional Navajo bun, and it's tied with red yarn. Mm-hmm. The reason I tie my hair with red yarn is to remind myself daily when I tie my hair of a crisis in Indian country known as missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls. Mm-hmm. We have a crisis in Indian country where literally hundreds, thousands of Indigenous women and girls have gone missing. They are been murdered. They've been reported by their families to law enforcement and to government agencies. And not only have most of these cases not been closed, but in many instances, they've never even been opened.
Wow.
There are stories of families being told by law enforcement and government agencies, you need to go look for these women yourself. We're not going to do it. And it's a crisis known as missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls. Now, when I was at the Frank Lemire Native American Presidential Forum last August, I was there with several of the Democratic candidates, Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren, Kamala Harris, Julian Castro, Marianne Williamson. Several of us were there. There was about 11 or 12 of us total at this forum. And one of the questions they asked was about missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls. Now, when most of the candidates learned about this crisis and responded to it, their response was something to the effect of, we have to write a new law or create a new policy to protect this demographic. And what I've been saying is, when your Declaration of Independence refers to natives as savages, and your Constitution never mentions women, you probably shouldn't be too surprised when your Indigenous women go missing or get murdered and society doesn't give a crap. A new law isn't going to fix this.
Right, there's a foundation issue.
This problem is rooted in the basis of our laws, and we have to change it there. So we have to address the white supremacy, the racism and the sexism embedded in our foundation. Most Americans believe that the United States of America struggles with racism, sexism, and white supremacy in spite of our foundations, right? Even Dr. King referred to our foundations as a blank check, but they're not a blank check. Again, they were written very explicitly to benefit a single demographic, white landowning men. And technically, if you want to be really honest, white landowning heterosexual Christian men. Everyone else gets the leftovers, if anything at all. And so this is where we have to deal with these things at a foundational level. And this is the thing, you know, I've been saying this frequently is right now, because of the tragedy and the public lynching of George Floyd.
Right.
And there is a very robust and healthy debate, not only about monuments and who we're honoring as a nation, but about policing and reforming our criminal justice system. And we are discussing everything from banning chokeholds and deciding whether or not we're going to shoot people in the chest or in the kneecaps, all the way down to defunding the police. And one of the things I tell people everywhere I go, everywhere I speak online right now, is that we have Joe Biden and Donald Trump promising to reform this institution in some way by adding this new law or this new policy. And I'm telling people my entrance into reforming our criminal justice system starts with abolishing slavery, because this is where Abraham Lincoln institutionalized white supremacy and constitutionally protected this institution known as slavery. Mm-hmm. And if we don't remove it from our foundations, any sort of reform is merely going to be cosmetic and not deal with the heart of the issue. Do we have to ban chokeholds? Do we have to do it? Yes, we do, probably. We have to rethink all the way we police stuff. But if we don't remove the institutionalized white supremacy and the constitutional protection for slavery from our constitution, we're never going to fix the problem. And I am the only candidate running in 2020 whose platform includes a plan to abolish slavery.
What are you seeing as far as the willingness to press into those deeper levels of conversation? Because I think they're more painful, right? Like in some ways, when you can function at just this policy level, you can kind of feel good at the end of the day. And it sounds like the kind of introspection that you're calling us to really involves a lot of painful honesty. Are you seeing an appetite for it?
Yes and no. The fact that my campaign is not getting much attention obviously means there's something blocking, you know, there's something, it's not going very far. But yes, because there's a lot of people who are getting on board. You know, we announced our campaign a year ago. And to this day, my campaign announcement video, which is 9 minutes in length, it's up on our website, markcharles2020.com, and on our YouTube channel. And that campaign video today is one of the best campaign tools we have. I get messages almost daily from people saying, I just saw your campaign video and it almost brought me to tears. Mm. Your vision, your thoughts, what we need to confront, how we need to go about it is so spot on, especially as these tensions have once again boiled to the forefront racially. They're always there, but right, every few months they boil up into the forefront and overtake the national dialogue, which is what happened in the past few months again. And so, yeah, I'm getting so many people. And one of the questions they're asking is, why have I never heard of you? Why have I never heard of you? Now, I'm also learning something else. And this is the more challenging aspect that I'm learning. One of the reasons, you know, I'm running for president because I want our nation to have this dialogue. And I've been talking on most of the themes of my campaign for the past decade, as I've been learning more, as I've been writing more. And it's kind of all being wrapped up into my campaign now. But I've been talking about many of these things for the past decade and to some fairly large audiences. Mm-hmm. I've had a fairly robust speaking schedule and within certain circles have a fairly good audience. It never went national. But my book, our message, my lectures have been fairly well received around the country. And I expected that running for president would only amplify that, when in reality, I felt like it muffled it more.
Interesting.
And I spend a lot of my time trying to understand how to be more persuasive and how to connect better with my audience. And I think I figured that I could start my campaign from the platform I had as a speaker and use that to step higher and into a broader platform in politics. I didn't account for the fact that running for president, not only did it fundamentally change me and my voice, but it fundamentally changed my audience. And those are the two things you have to understand the best to be a persuasive speaker. You have to know who you are and have expertise on your topics, which I have the expertise, but I didn't calculate how I would change what would change about me going from speaker and activist to politician. And I didn't account for what it would do to my audience. So the things I talk about, they're compelling. There's a lot of vision. And for 10 years, there was a growing momentum within my platform to engage in these things. But I was an activist and nothing was going to change, at least not in the very near future. Right. So I was talking about a vision. I was talking about an idea. I was talking about, wouldn't it be nice if this happened? But there was no real danger of those things changing next week, next month, or even next year.
It's the kind of thing you can sit in a conference where you're speaking and at the end of the day, go home and continue on the same patterns and feel like I should keep thinking about that.
And now as a politician, as someone running for not just local office, but president, now I'm talking about things that not only is a compelling idea, but I'm saying, hey, we can start implementing this in 6 months. And people are suddenly hearing it as like, oh, crap. Like, this is dangerous, you know?
Right.
And I tell people I'm not the Christian candidate. I'm not running to make the nation Christian. I've seen what happens. And this is why we're in the problems we're in the first place, is because of the heresy of Christian empire, which we addressed in the beginning of our book. And so I'm adamant, I'm not the Christian candidate. And I don't deny the fact that I'm a Christian, but I'm not trying to make my nation Christian. I'm not trying to legislate my theologies. But I also, I've studied the Bible. I've read the Bible. I've written about the Bible for most of my life. And I love looking at the challenges that get presented throughout the scriptures. And there's one interaction that Jesus had that has drawn my attention more, especially in the last few weeks, where, again, people call me and email me and message me, how come I've never heard of you before? And there's this story in the book of John, I think it's chapter 5, where Jesus goes down to the pool of Bethesda, where people who are sick or are lame, and they're lying around the pool waiting for the angel to come and stir the water, and the first person into the water gets healed. And Jesus comes upon this pool, and there's a man who's been there for 38 years. And Jesus asks him what seemingly is a very simple question. Do you want to be healed? And the guy doesn't say yes, nor does he say no. He gives an excuse why he's not healed.
And everybody put me in, right?
Yeah. There's no one to help me. Other people get in there faster. Well, I think the vision of getting healed is compelling. Actually, getting healed is scary because it means things change, and we're all scared of change. Everyone's scared of change. It doesn't matter who you are. And so Jesus asked him a simple question. Do you want to be healed? And he doesn't give him an answer. And then Jesus doesn't even wait for an answer. He just heals the guy. Right. And what it's done for me, again, I'm not Jesus. I'm not trying to make the nation Christian. That's not my goal. I'm not trying to force anything on anyone. But how do I frame my dialogue? And so I'm actually framing my dialogue instead of, we can abolish slavery. We can remove the racism. Instead of casting it as a vision, I'm beginning to frame it more as a question. Do you want to live in a nation where slavery is abolished?
Like, yes, right?
Well, again, yes, but then what does that mean? Well, it means for-profit prisons are out. It means...
Right. Yes, and then it's so disruptive.
Yeah, so this week I've been changing my messaging of, instead of trying to cast a vision, I'm literally trying to ask people, do you really want this?
Mark, it seems like, you know, at the core of your campaign is really trying to provide representation too for underrepresented folks, but also to challenge, you know, some of these core aspects of what we consider American identity to help us move forward in terms of racial equality and things like that. I almost hate to even ask you this question, so you can choose to not answer or decide whatever. But since your campaign is based on the idea of we the people should mean all the people, it sounds like your desire to represent underrepresented folks is really at the forefront. But then how do you navigate that with the fact that there are still a lot of white male voters? And I hate to say it this way, because I don't want to be the white guy saying, well, what about me? As if like I haven't been catered to for my whole existence. You know what I mean? So how do you navigate that?
Yeah. One of the things I say frequently is the goal of my campaign is I am trying to decenter whiteness. I am not working to oppress white people. I don't even want to give them a taste of their own medicine. I want to decenter them. Now, when you're used to being treated as superior, when you're used to having everything be about you, being treated just as an average person is going to feel oppressive, even though it's not. Mm-hmm. And so my entire campaign is around decentering whiteness. I've lived in a lot of places. I've attended large universities. I've worked in large corporations. I've lived on the reservation. I've lived off the reservation. I've lived in border towns. I've lived in big cities. I've all over the country. I can tell you definitively one of the most racist, white supremacist and sexist spaces I have ever been in is running for president, the office of president of the United States. Mm. If you want a space that is most clearly designed for white landowning men to thrive in every capacity, run for president, because every single thing that can be slicked and greased and made easier for that demographic has been done and has been embedded for 250 years. And so my entire strategy, if I am going to become president, it is not going to be with the vote of white landowning men. It's going to be in spite of the vote of white landowning men. That's the only way I ever get to be president. Mm. Because the whole system, from how politics is set up to where you campaign first, to where the first primaries and caucuses are held, to who controls the media and what who you have to pay to buy your ads, everything about this system goes through white landowning men. And they have the least amount of interest in actually changing the system, which is why it's 2020 and we still haven't decided we want to constitutionally treat women as equal or abolish slavery.
Mark, thanks so much for being with us today. Really appreciate your time. And if people want to get involved with your campaign, it's markcharles2020.com.
Yeah, our website is markcharles2020.com. They can go there to sign up for our newsletter. They can go there to, if you go to our ballot access page, we're trying to get on the ballot in all 50 states right now. And so if you click on ballot access, there's a link for all 50 states. You can find out what we're doing in your state to get on the ballot there. We're collecting states electronically in the state of Illinois. We're collecting them remotely in New Mexico, Alaska, North Dakota, and New Hampshire. And because of COVID-19, rules and regulations are changing almost daily. So we're trying to stay on top of all of that. We're in the middle of our best fundraising month ever of our entire campaign. We've raised over $12,000 this month, and that's allowed us to add staff. We're trying to raise more money to get on the ballot through some states like Oklahoma, Colorado, and Louisiana, where we don't have to collect signatures. We just need to pay a fee so people can donate to our campaign. And then we're also on social media. We're on Instagram, we're on Twitter, Facebook, and we're going to start using our TikTok account this week too. We're actually going to put up, we're debating what my first post on TikTok is going to be. I did a little live stream last week where I talked about, someone asked me a question of, will I ever wear a suit? My answer is no, I'm not going to wear a suit. I'm going to be the first president who's gone through 4 to 8 years in office without ever wearing a suit. And I gave my both my tongue-in-cheek response as well as my deep historical analysis and why it would not ever be appropriate for me as a Native man to wear a suit in the White House. So we're hoping that will capture some of the fun side. I'm not going to be someone on TikTok who's dancing and, you know, doing this sort of thing. I can't pretend I'm someone I'm not, but we will try to make it a fun account, and especially we'll be very intentional to reach out to Gen Z and millennials on TikTok beginning this week. So I'm looking forward to doing that.
Thanks again, Mark. Great talking with you. Really appreciate your time here today.
Yeah, well, thank you very much. I look forward to having this dialogue continue to move forward. I appreciate the invitation to get on your show, and I hope things go very well for you. So, akiahat and hakone.
Thank you.
One thing that I was thinking about as I was reading through his stuff is, I'm like, man, it's just a privilege to have a presidential candidate, a legitimate presidential candidate, to be able to have this conversation with. And I think one common theme that, think about the stuff that Mark was talking about. Think about the need for racial equality. Think about the need to deconstruct our racist history. This is stuff we've been talking about for weeks. This is on the podcast. You know, like, these are the themes that are very much so in sympathy conversations we're having. You know, I was thinking, as all the George Floyd stuff was happening, like, real change isn't going to happen in this country until we get a candidate who will make racial equality and justice the priority of their campaign. And here comes Mark, which clearly that is the priority of his campaign, you know, is to deconstruct, to make we the people for all the people. and especially for the people who've been underrepresented and overlooked. Isn't that interesting? So what stuck out to you in terms of things that Mark had said today?
Oh man, there's so much, right? It's kind of like, you pushed on this, I don't know, maybe a month or two ago. We talked about how one of the things that I've mentioned is, as an interculturalist, one of the things that I try to do is enter into somebody else's space, right? And to understand who they are in their space. And then one of the things that you'd push back on me on is saying, well, what about being like, is there some way to be consistent, you know, while also entering into somebody else's space? And so I think that one of the things that I felt here in Mark is I was trying to discern the distinction between me as entering into his space and me in terms of what I, in my core, in a settled way, believe to be true. And I think that there was a great moment of clarity for me when he asked the question, and I think this is why it's so powerful to ask questions, right? He asked the question, do you want to live in a country that's abolished slavery? Well, yeah, like that, I don't have to think about that, right? Am I comfortable with the language of decentering whiteness? Well, okay. I have been engaged in that process in my own life, right? So the words have this emotional weight to them that a part of what's hard is I think about people that I care about that I think might only be able to hear that as an attack on them as people.
Which he clearly didn't mean it as.
No, but it is an attack on a system. It's an attack on a implicit or sometimes explicit belief that white people should be at the center. Here's something crazy. Okay, so we talked a couple of weeks ago about this issue of race, colorblindness and race. And so I was doing a little bit more reading afterwards, trying to understand this whole thing of the idea of race, genetic race, being tied to traits. This is kind of this old idea. And I assumed, based on kind of what I had interacted with, that the deconstruction of that had started in the 50s or 60s. Uh-huh. And then I came across Ruth Benedict, who was an anthropologist, who was deconstructing it in the 30s. And who actually published a very controversial work in, I think, 1941. It was right toward the beginning of the wartime. It was deconstructing race. And I was thinking about that we have these attachments to some of these ideas for a long time that we've known, or we could have known for a long time, that the way that we've thought about it is inaccurate. So I'm a little bit of a jumbled mess because all these things are tying together for me. Did that make any sense at all?
No, it made sense. Yeah. I'm wondering myself about some of the reactions after George Floyd's death, where I feel like there's this sense for some people of like how important this upcoming election is. And I think people who tend to be sympathetic with Black Lives Matter and with some of the movements that have really been flourishing even more since those events. I wonder if the sentiment is like, all right, time to vote a certain way to get a certain person out of office. Where I wonder actually if those same folks heard Mark, if they'd realize that like there seems to be a candidate who is far more sympathetic to the cause than either of the two major candidates are, but where there might still just be this reactional vote where it's kind of like, I don't know, time to get Trump out of office or something. I don't know. I just kind of wonder, in some ways, I hope Mark has a chance to have some of his message heard by a wider audience, because I think that he's speaking in a timely manner when it comes to some of these things, where there will be many sympathetic voices, but to what extent those voices are just going to cast a vote against somebody will be interesting to see. I feel like that's kind of at some of the foundations of Mark's campaign, is this idea of a reexamination of our historical roots. But he's doing good history. He's not just throwing out jargon, I think, to try to shock people into thinking something. He's actually pulling from real history, and he's revealing it and unpacking it in ways that I think could make people uncomfortable, but that are deeply rooted.
But should make us uncomfortable, right?
Exactly. It should make us uncomfortable. Yeah, I'm very sympathetic, I think, to what he's doing with that, as much as it's painful as a white male to hear. It's important. And I wonder in some ways, what I thought was so interesting is the ways that his campaign provides a contrast to both the major Republican and major Democratic candidates.
It really throws them into relief, doesn't it? It's like the light that it shines. It's like, oh, this really does feel like two versions of the same thing. So this reminds me of, I don't know, it was maybe 2003 or something. I was talking with a British guy that it was around when Fox News became big. I don't remember exactly when it launched, but so this guy who's a British missiologist, what's his name? Richard Tiplady, I think, was talking about CNN as being the conservative news network. And I was like, no, no, that's Fox. And he's like, no, it's the conservative news network. And I was like, what on earth do you mean? And he said, they never challenge the narrative. Mm-hmm. It's the same narrative. It's just two different flavors of the same narrative.
Yeah.
And in that way, it's very conservative. And he was saying that in a derogatory way, right? That when we believe that CNN and Fox are opposites, or MSNBC and Fox are opposites, then our world is actually very small, because they're actually two flavors of the same thing, right? If we believe that Donald Trump and Joe Biden are opposites, I mean, and Mark has made this observation, right? That these are two white, wealthy, landowning men.
Yeah.
Right? Like they're not opposites. They're very similar.
Even where their views differ on a lot of things, they are very similar. And the idea of deconstructing implicit versus explicit racism, I think, was really interesting, because that sort of dichotomy, I think, that he mentioned about the 2016 election, I've heard many times. Mm-hmm. I think it's why so many people that I heard from lamented the election of Trump, because they thought somehow that his campaign represented the bad and the other campaign represented the good. And I think what Mark's deconstructing a little bit is that how deeply problematic some of these things are coming from both Republican and Democratic circles. Mm-hmm. And so I think his point on that is worth thinking more about.
And you and I have both been uncomfortable with the left versus right dichotomy. Right.
Yeah, I can't, I guess this is exposing myself, but I can't remember the last time I vote for a Republican or a Democrat for president.
Whereas I have voted for a Republican for president, I voted for a Democrat for president, and I have voted third party. Like, yeah. I feel very unsettled with that. Yeah.
Yeah, I feel unsettled with the establishment. So I always love voting third party because I feel like, man, I want the system to change to where those aren't the only voices that we hear in our society. Mm. And so I feel like that's why I like to cast my vote. And that's not to say I just pick a, pick a dart on the dartboard. I do, try to do to the extent that's possible some research candidates other than the major two, you might say.
Right.
It's not so encouraging in some ways about hearing from Mark is that there had been this tendency with some third party candidates, I think, in the past to that I've heard of and that I've heard from is to run on some fairly narrow ideological concepts. Mm-hmm. And I feel like Mark's ideology for why he's running is very pointed, but it reaches far further than most third party candidates do.
Thank you for joining us for today's episode of Professors in Rooms Getting Coffee. We plan to post the other half of our conversation with Mark in next week's episode. Our theme music is by Josiah Enns. Lindsay Zell was the editing assistant. We hope you can join us for coffee again next week.